The very thought of you makes my heart sing like an April breeze on the wings of spring, and you appear in all your splendor, my one and only love. The shadows fall and spread their mystic charms in the hush of night while you're in my arms. I feel your lips so warm and tender, my one and only love. The touch of your hand.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
This is American Standoff, and I'm your host, Jacqueline Keeler, and this is a weekly show that looks at the standoff in the American political divide from an indigenous perspective, my own. I'm Jacqueline Keeler, as I mentioned. I'm a native journalist based here in Oregon. And as you all recall, and I open every show with this, so excuse me if it is repetitive, but over a year ago, on January 6, 2021, thousands of supporters of former President Trump gathered in D.C. and later stormed the Capitol, contesting President Biden's election. They were alleging that it had been stolen, and which is referred to as the big lie, in which actually many Republican candidates in 2022 are running on this big lie. Also, we experienced a similar just about a few weeks before, and we saw our own Capitol in Salem stormed by armed insurrectionists protesting COVID restrictions. Today on American Standoff, we're discussing public hearings kicking off this week, in fact, tonight, as the House Select Committee investigating January 6th zeroes in on former President Donald Trump's role. President Trump's role in the insurrection that day, and is preparing to investigate in prime time tonight whether he was responsible for grave abuses of power that nearly upended U.S. democracy. The committee's central mission has been to uncover the full scope of Trump's unprecedented attempt to stop the transfer of power to President Joe Biden. This includes Trump's attempts to overturn his 2020 defeat by pressuring state and federal officials, and what committee members say was his dereliction of duty on January 6th while his supporters ransacked the U.S. Capitol. On the show, American Standoff, we examine the connections between seemingly disparate events like this and their origins in white supremacy and the DNA of colonialism and the ongoing occupation of indigenous homelands in the United States. My name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am your host. This is a call-in show, so please do feel free to call in. The number is 503-231-8187. Lawmakers will be trying to convict Trump in the court of public opinion, which is really all they can do, because it's not within the power of this committee to actually indict Trump. What do they have? They have an emerging legal foundation to claim that Trump broke the law, thanks to a landmark court ruling from a federal judge who said it was more likely than not that Trump committed crimes on January 6th. So these hearings, which will be broadcast during prime time, will be the panel's first chance to really show the public what they've learned after more than 1,000 witness interviews, 135,000 documents, just a ton of information that's been coming out about January 6th and that has come to light since Trump's impeachment trial in February 2021, when he was acquitted of one count of incitement of insurrection. And so this has a lot more information, although it does not have the sort of the weight of an actual impeachment. And so we are, a quote here from Representative Jamie Raskin, we are going to tell the story of a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 presidential election and block the transfer of power. And he's a Maryland Democrat who serves on the committee. He spoke to the Washington Post and added the committee has found evidence of concerted planning and premeditated activity related to the events of January 6th. So let's listen to some audio of a documentary filmmaker, Nick Quested's, his potential testimony and video evidence that he filmed around the events of January 6th and the involvement of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers.
Shell on Thursday, don't you run the risk of losing the public's attention here?
We're aiming at people, an audience, frankly, that still has an open mind about these facts.
Yeah.
We want to counter the continuing propagation of big lies, and that's what our goal is.
We're a year and a half away from the attack. Trump is no longer the president. The test for the committee really is here to figure out how they're going to get people to tune back in to all the results of their investigation and their eventual report.
Okay, I think that was the wrong audio there. We're looking for the audio about the filmmaker Nick Quested's footage on the Proud Boys planning.
Freedom!
This morning, exclusively on ABC, we're seeing extraordinary, never-before-seen video of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, taken by documentary filmmaker Nick Quested, who turned over hours of footage to the January 6th committee. He was right there with the Proud Boys and others as they marched on the Capitol. He captured the chaos outside.
I am not allowed to say what's going to happen today, because everyone's just going to have to watch for themselves. But it's going to happen. Something's going to happen, one way or the other.
The first barricades going down. Clashes on the inaugural platform, a rioter falling off the balcony. The police assaulted, rioters using flagpoles as weapons. Reaction when the building is breached.
We have stormed the Capitol!
Right on!
And inside the Capitol?
Move out! Move out! All we want is policy!
A member of his film crew capturing the scene outside Nancy Pelosi's office. The video was shot just minutes after Speaker Pelosi was evacuated from the building by the Capitol Police. Quested himself was assaulted, a rioter seen here trying to smash his camera. In footage previously released by the Justice Department, Quested videotaped Proud Boys leader Enrique Terrio as he was released from prison and on the eve of the riot. meeting in an underground parking garage on Capitol Hill with another militant leader,
Stuart
Rhodes of the Oath Keepers. On day one of the hearings, the committee hopes to document the horror of the day on Capitol Hill and Donald Trump's failure to do anything to stop it.
You'll never take back our country with weakness.
In addition to Quested, they'll hear live testimony from Capitol Police Officer Caroline Edwards, who was injured when rioters broke through the barricades. And we will hear taped testimony from some of those closest to Trump when it all went down, including his daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner. The committee plans several more hearings later this month with the aim of showing that this was far more than a riot. It was a months-long effort led by President Trump himself to overturn a presidential election.
So there you heard a our opener audio, which has to do with the footage shot by a filmmaker named Nick Quested, who is being subpoenaed and will be speaking tonight, we believe. Maybe they're not sure if it's going to be today at this hearing, but he is going to be speaking and showing that was some really new audio, video footage of some of the evidence that the filmmaker is presenting to the committee, the January 6th committee. And really the role of these far right groups like Proud Boys and Oath Keepers in directly coordinating with leadership, with Republican leadership, particularly around Trump, on this event and on the January 6th insurrection. They it should also be noted that the Proud Boys have actually taken over the Miami-Dade Republican Party, and so have gone from being sort of a fringe group marching on the streets to a group that is actually going to have political power, and who knows how they will do in the 2022 elections, which could be quite alarming if they actually begin to win offices and stuff. So good morning. This is American Standoff. We're a live talk radio show. So do call into the studio if you want to be part of this conversation. The number here is 503-231-8187. And my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm your host. And I always like to start the show off with an introduction in my own language. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. In Navajo way, we also introduce ourselves to our clans. And my clan is Kiani Nishlith, and I am born for the Yankton Sioux people. My father was Ihansawan Dakota Yankton Sioux. And so I am also a citizen of the Navajo Nation. So I'd also like to acknowledge that what we now call Portland, Oregon, is located on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. And the question I ask every episode of American Standoff, and we actually, as I've mentioned before, launched this show on the anniversary of the January 6th, 2021 insurrection. So we launched this on January 6th, 2022. And when we all saw, the storming of the Capitol, and the question I ask is, what have we learned? This week's episode, we are actually going to be seeing the first live televised hearings by the January 6th House Committee, and we're going to be hearing testimony for the first time. I wanted to dedicate this show to actually sort of getting an overview of what you can expect and what we might be hearing. So please do call in if you have any sort of thoughts on this committee or thoughts on what is going to be presented and the seriousness of the threat of to democracy, of civil society. One of the things I think that we don't talk enough about civil society in this country and the importance of it, because we take it for granted to a certain extent. I mean, we just had a judge assassinated recently, and constant threats on killing governors, like the governor of Michigan. This is a sign of the breakdown of civil society, and I never really heard that term before until I actually traveled to Chiapas, Mexico, to attend an indigenous conference there, which was attended by indigenous people from across the hemisphere, North and South America, and I met with we're right in Chiapas, Mexico. You're on the border with Guatemala, and the Mayan people That's both Chiapas, the state of Chiapas in Mexico, and Guatemala, of course, the traditional homelands of the Mayan people and Mayan nation. And so I got to meet a lot of folks from that nation, both traditional villagers living up in the mountains of Chiapas, and also I met representatives from Guatemala at this conference. And I was very young. I was just out of college, and so talking to them, of course, through a translator. I'm not fluent in Spanish or their languages, their Mayan languages, and they really talked to me a lot as a young person from the north about the issue of civil society, because of course, you know, when Trump puts down countries, you know, he calls them names, and I won't repeat those names here, but you know, he's talking about countries that have gone through really difficult breakdowns in civil society and the kind of the rise of these oligarchies. Now, of course, we have oligarchies here in the United States. We've always had them. And in my if you read my book Standoff, you'll see that I go into how basically the Revolutionary War was conducted by an oligarchy of wealthy white men who had similar interests and worked in concert with one another to take over Indian land. And but this is a different sort of thing. And what we've seen with the rise of Trump and his sort of kind of mafia sort of tactics, and I don't choose mafia lightly, because of course I think I mentioned this on the show before, but when I was 18 years old and I did a summer internship in New York City after my freshman year in college, and I was on a taxi, and a taxi driver drove me past the Trump Tower, and he looked at that, and he's a New Yorker white guy, and he was just like, Trump's a member of the mafia, there's no way you can get anything built here in New York City without being, and he actually called Trump a front for the mafia, a blonde Aryan front for the mafia, and I, as a kid, I was just like, I didn't understand really what he was talking about, but I think that there are these sorts of kind of bullying tactics and a way of maintaining power, and I think that Trump is introducing these, and what we'll be seeing in the hearing and the testimony. Okay, am I on now?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. I got cut off there for a moment. So I was just saying that what we'll be seeing in these hearings tonight is some evidence to the level of which the structure, the power structure of our country has altered and is under deep duress through the forces of sort of this mafioso or strongman organizational style, and this is very detrimental to democracy and detrimental to civil society. And so what we are seeing, not really in slow motion, I think it's happening quite quickly, and when I was started examining this issue in 2016, when I started writing my book Standoff in 2017 and really began taking a deep dive after interviewing on the ground oath keepers and 3%ers, working in concert with the Bundys on these takeovers, we're seeing a really rapid, where these were once fringe groups, although of course Republican state legislators and other folks came to support the Bundys, obviously, but these were once fringe groups, and now they've taken over the Republican Party with an assist from Trump, and have been working in concert, and to level which we will have evidence will be presented in these hearings. And so let's listen to a brief overview of what to expect today.
But if you don't deliver a bombshell on Thursday, don't you run the risk of losing the public's attention here?
We're aiming at people, an audience, frankly, that still has an open mind about these facts.
Yeah.
We want to counter the continuing propagation of big lies, and that's what our goal is.
We're a year and a half away from the attack. Trump is no longer the president. The test for the committee really is here to figure out how they're going to get people to tune back in to all the results of their investigation and their eventual report.
I think people are going to be absolutely surprised how much was known with multiple groups. And I think that's what's going to be exciting to see the committee. There's some very talented investigators behind the doors. I think I do think they're going to be very successful in those six. I think in those six hearings.
What makes these hearings different than the impeachment hearings is that this is the product of much more investigation. They don't want, you know, a dry presentation that people are going to tune out of, right? They're holding these hearings in prime time and in top morning slots where they're hoping to get the maximal amount of media coverage. The committee's been very tight-lipped about who exactly they want to call as witnesses. What we can expect is that they will be people that were perhaps in the vice president's inner circle and in Trump's inner circle.
We're not commenting on specific witnesses. It's certainly one of the themes that we will be fleshing out is the fact that in advance of the 6th, that there was an understanding of the propensity for violence that day.
The committee has announced two witnesses for Thursday's hearing. Capitol Police Officer Caroline Edwards, the first law enforcement officer who was injured by rioters, and filmmaker Nick Quested, a documentary filmmaker who took footage of much of the riot on January 6th. This is all part of the committee's attempt to try to tell the story of what happened that day. Republicans have been struggling to figure out how exactly to respond to these hearings. They don't have that much insight into how the committee's been planning and who exactly they're trying to call to testify and the like. Since the only two Republicans on the panel, Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and Liz Cheney of Wyoming, are no fans of the current House Republican leadership.
We have too many people now in the Republican Party who are not taking their responsibility seriously and who have pledged their allegiance and loyalty to Donald Trump.
Look, my view on the committee has not changed. They're not conducting a legitimate investigation. It seems as though they just want to go after their political opponents.
There are rumblings among Republicans of trying to put out some kind of counter report. It will have not nearly the same kind of impact that the January 6th committee's report will have, simply because they lack the kind of subpoena power and, you know, legislative authority that a congressional committee like this has. This is something that some Democrats certainly see as a way to show Republicans as unfit for office in the coming elections or even in 2024, especially as some Republican candidates really have embraced some of these conspiracy theories about the 2020 election.
If you didn't like Trump before the hearing, you're probably still not going to like him. If you did like President Trump going into the hearing, well, you're not going to watch or pay attention to any part of it, so you're still going to like President Trump on the other side. They think in their minds, well, people at home will stop what they're doing at 8 p.m. at night.
Trump has regularly railed against the committee even since it was started. As they actually go into these hearings, Trump world has suffered from the same issue that House Republicans do, which is that they don't actually have that much insight into what the committee is doing. So we can expect much of what Trump world and Republicans writ large to be mostly reactive to what comes out. Unlike other congressional investigations, there's somewhat of a less clear end goal. The committee can present legislative findings at the end. They can present its report. They can present ways to try to safeguard democracy. But it's not as concrete of an ending as, say, impeaching the president and then either having him convicted or acquitted. In addition to what the committee has been doing here on the Hill, there is a parallel Department of Justice investigation into January 6th and its aftermath. We know that the Department of Justice has still been wrapping up its investigation into all of the defendants, but they have touched in some ways the committee's investigation as well. So even if the congressional side of this wraps up, there still will be this Department of Justice side of the investigation.
Okay. So this is Jacqueline Keeler again, and that was a little bit, the audio wasn't so great on that. It was kind of quiet, but there was a, it was an overview, sort of bulleted overview of what to expect in tonight's hearing and what to expect in the series of hearings that are going to be happening this month with the January 6th committee, House committee. So once again, this is American Standoff, and we're a live radio talk show, so please do feel free to call in. I mean, how do you feel about this, about this committee? How do you feel about, what's coming forward, about what happened on January 6, 2021, and in the case of the footage of the Nick Quested, the documentary filmmaker, you know, things that he found, that he's video that's already been released of sort of meetings that happened on January 5th between between Proud Boy leaders and Oath Keeper leaders, and how they were working to plan this with Trump and Trump loyalists. Once again, you can call in here at 503-231-8187, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. Here's a breakdown of what the panel and the press has found so far about Trump's potential role in the anti-democratic uprising that happened on January 6, 2021, and how it fits into the ongoing criminal investigations. Because although this this committee cannot actually have, it's not a criminal investigation, it doesn't have the power, it does fit into other ongoing criminal investigations that are happening. There's been looking, so the committee has interviewed officials from Michigan and Georgia, among other states where Trump unsuccessfully tried to cajole local officials into nullifying Biden's votes and naming him the winner. This is, we've seen quite a high profile fight that he had with the Secretary of State of Georgia, you know, trying to run a candidate against him in the last party primary, but Trump was unable to unseat these Republican leaders in Georgia who had refused to side with him on scuttling the results of the election that favored Biden. He also tried to enlist senior Justice Department officials to assist with these efforts. Lawmakers have also dug into a fake electors plot, which was led by the Trump campaign and was an attempt to undermine the Electoral College process on December 2020. And in fact, the insurrection itself was timed at the exact same time that the Electoral College results were being actually certified by Pence. And of course, that is why Pence is such a focus of Trump's his attention and his bile as well. And so congressional investigators have obtained hundreds of emails from right-wing attorney John Eastman, who directly advised Trump to pursue legally dubious methods to stay in office. This included a plan for then Vice President Mike Pence to throw the election to Trump on January 6th while presiding over a joint session of Congress to certify Biden's Electoral College victory. And in fact, there were repeated calls to Trump to basically, tell the insurrectionists to stand down, and he didn't say anything until about 5 p.m. So giving plenty of time to disrupt the proceedings that were going on to certify the Electoral College results. And they'll be examining what they call Trump's dereliction of duty during the Capitol riot. Once Trump failed to stop states from certifying the results, he started focusing on January 6th as his last chance to cling to power. The facts of that tragic day are well known, but the panel is going to try to drive home a clear narrative from the chaos. So Trump knew his supporters would get violent, that's what they're going to assert, but he egged them on anyway. And the dereliction occurs because he didn't try to stop the violence, right? And there's some evidence that the testimony given by his daughter, Ivanka Trump, and her husband, Jared Kushner, may also play into evidence that he did not do anything. And so they observed him egging on these folks. So here's a quote from Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming, who was also vice chairwoman of the panel. She said in March, they were warned that January 6th could and likely would turn violent. Let's listen to some audio, actually, about Liz Cheney and how she, of all people, ended up leading the Republican fight against Trump and the January 6th insurrection.
It was June 24th, 2021, almost a full year ago, that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced it was past time for Congress to investigate the assault on the Capitol by supporters of Donald Trump and his big election lie.
Our temple of democracy was attacked by insurrectionists. It is imperative that we seek the truth as to what happened. To do that, we believe that a bipartisan commission would be the best way to proceed.
Pelosi and congressional Democrats had already been working for months to put together an independent 9/11-style commission to investigate the attack, and the Senate had voted by a 54-35 majority to create that commission. But that was six votes short of what they needed to break a Republican filibuster led by Mitch McConnell. And so last June, Pelosi said enough was enough.
I asked, leading up to today, is there a chance for it to pass? We gave it so much time. Not soon. Not likely. Maybe someday. In the meantime, this morning, with great solemnity and sadness, I'm announcing that the House will be establishing a select committee on the January 6th insurrection.
On Thursday night, in prime time, that committee will begin to present its findings to the public in live televised hearings. And it's worth recalling the conditions the panel has worked in. Remember, even after the House committee was created, Republicans tried to turn this investigative vehicle into a clown car. They tried to install Trump loyalists and big lie defenders, Jim Jordan and Jim Banks, on the committee, even as Jordan appeared to conceal the fact that he had spoken multiple times with Trump by phone on January the 6th. And when the House panel did add two Republican members, Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, the Republican Party censured and basically exiled them, and also effectively dismissed the largest sacking of the U.S. Capitol since the War of 1812 as, quote, legitimate political discourse. Nearly 100 subpoenas and more than 1,000 interviews later, what will we learn Thursday night? We know that the first slate of witnesses will include a documentary filmmaker who followed the extremist Proud Boys group both before and during the insurrection, suggesting there's more than we know to the far-right gang's involvement in the assault. Perhaps more importantly, we know that the committee is going to recommend some reforms, but there's disagreement on the panel over what they should be. Axios reported on Wednesday that panel member Jamie Raskin wants to abolish the Electoral College altogether, saying a direct popular vote in future elections would prevent the sort of subversion of congressional counts and sending of fake electors that the Trump team attempted. But conservative Liz Cheney says that's too radical. She's open to fixing the Electoral Count Act and is working with fellow committee member Democrat Zoe Lofgren on a reform proposal. Cheney reportedly also refuses to endorse Democratic election reforms like the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Let's discuss it with two January 6th scoop machines. Joining me now is Hugo Lowell, congressional reporter for The Guardian. Also here is Politico national correspondent Betsy Woodruff-Swan. Thank you both for coming back on the show. Betsy, let me start with you.
I'm extremely interested in whatever Nick Quested, this documentary filmmaker, has in regards to a meeting on January 5th between the head of the Proud Boys and the head of the Oath Keepers. Quested previously told Politico that he had footage of that meeting. It's something he's shared with the Select Committee and discussed with investigators on that panel. The extent to which he's able to elucidate any level of coordination, communication, discussion prior to January 6th between these two separate and different far-right extremist groups that joined forces on that day is something that has the potential to be quite interesting and revelatory. We know one theme for the Select Committee that they expect to suss out over the course of these investigations is that the violence on January 6th was not a freak incident and it was not a random outbreak of violence. Rather, they're going to be making the case that it was pre-planned, it was predetermined, and it was a goal, not a fluke, of the people who attacked the Capitol building.
Hugo, you broke the news that Thursday's witnesses will include that filmmaker Nick Queston, who followed the Proud Boys around. That comes just as the DOJ has charged five Proud Boys who were at the Capitol with seditious conspiracy. We knew about their participation in the insurrection, but is there new evidence behind the focus on this extremist group?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the evidence has come from the DOJ side, as Betsy mentioned, right? There was the January 5 underground parking garage meeting that involved Enrique Tarrio, the leader of the Proud Boys, and Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the Oath Keepers. And the Select Committee, I mean, we have previously reported, believes there was some sort of coordination in the days and weeks leading up to the Capitol attack that culminated with that meeting in the underground parking garage. And there's lots of evidence for that, including text messages among the Proud Boy leadership, text messages among the Oath Keeper leadership. And the problem with these groups is a lot of their members have crossover. So there is at least one person, Joshua James, who is a member of both the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. And so the idea that these two groups weren't coordinating in advance of the Capitol attack and yet ended up at the Capitol and stormed the Capitol building is just not believable. The problem is that Nick Queston is not expected to testify tomorrow about the January 5 meeting. They're going to focus very much on what happened on January 6. So it's not entirely clear how deep they'll get into the planning.
And Betsy, the Washington Post reported this week that on January the 6th, the Secret Service tried to meet Donald Trump's request for him to march on the Capitol with his supporters or drive with them, but they nixed it when the D.C. police said they were spread too thin to help. And you just reported that the January 6th panel has interviewed the head of Trump's Secret Service detail from that day. What more does that tell us about the insurrection itself as it went down on January 6th?
Well, it tells us that Trump was absolutely dedicated to the idea of going to the Capitol building with his supporters who were traveling there, which of course stands in contrast to what some of his own former White House aides have said was his intent that day. What we also know is the Select Committee has interviewed Robert Engel, who was a special agent in charge of Trump's presidential protective detail, his Secret Service detail, on January 6th. Engel was very close to Trump throughout the entire day, from socks on to socks off. He traveled in the armored vehicle called the Beast from the White House to the rally. He was backstage with Trump at the rally. When he was backstage, he played a key role in the Secret Service deciding that it would just not be physically possible for Trump to move from the Ellipse to the Capitol building. Trump really, really wanted to go, and the Secret Service isn't supposed to control the president's movements, no matter how ill-advised those movements might be. But what Engel and other colleagues of his in the Secret Service and in the Metropolitan Police Department quickly assessed was that regardless of the president's wishes, it would basically defy the law of physics to try to transport him there. We know the Select Committee has a lot of detail on that.
So let's talk about some of the Trump boosters. Hugo, Fox has announced they will not be running these hearings live at Thursday, 8 p.m. Host Laura Ingraham said on Tuesday night, the network is just giving the customers what they want. Have a listen.
Prime time. They're all upset that Fox isn't covering it live. We actually do something called, you know, cater to our audience. Our audience knows what this is. We'll cover it. We'll do plenty of coverage.
This is a scripted political convention.
It's total theater.
Put aside the fact that she's saying the quiet part loud there. We cater to our audience. They don't want to hear this, so we won't tell them about it. This is also a host who was texting Trump's chief of staff during the insurrection on the network that ran 1,100 segments on Benghazi, and she's complaining about political theater. What is Fox afraid of here, do you think?
I mean, it's not so much the audience doesn't want to hear it. It's probably that the hosts don't want to hear it because, as you say, they were texting Mark Meadows, Trump's White House chief of staff, while the insurrection was happening and was trying to get him to call the rioters off. And, of course, none of them were really successful. But it shows that the Fox hosts who were texting Meadows knew that the Capitol attack was bad and that it was a really bad moment for, you know, political for the Republicans and for democracy at large. And so now that they've been exposed, or CNN has exposed those text messages, it's quite clear that they don't want that out on their networks, and so that their audiences will know what they are up to during the attack, how they perceive the attack.
When those text messages got leaked, they had time to come up with their excuses and their rebuttals for their primetime shows. It's very different if you're reading out references to Hannity Ingraham live on Fox as it goes out on air, I guess.
So that was Mehdi Hasan on MSNBC and discussing what to expect today. I actually, a little error in my script there. I had was going to transition to Liz Cheney's role. But you know, this is very interesting, a lot of what they brought up. You know, as you know, I do a lot of reporting and investigation of right-wing extremism in this country. When some of the right-wing extremists were marching in Washington, D.C., actually in Portland, Oregon, I did get a chance to interview some of them. I focused on the actual right-wing guys of color, right? The Patriot Prayer Group that marched here in Portland, I think in 2018, in the summer of 2018. One of the things that's sort of interesting about a lot of all this, and I think I will do a show looking more closely at the Proud Boys, is the leader of the far-right Proud Boys who was charged, and four of the group's members who were charged with seditious conspiracy for their alleged planning and participation in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. They include Enrique Tarrio, who seemed to be the leader. Of course, the Proud Boys was not founded by Enrique Tarrio. It was founded by Gavin. What's his name? he was one of the founders of Vice News, and so he actually is the one who started the Proud Boys, and Gavin McInnes, and so he is the one that got their whole little uniform going and everything. And the idea was that they were proud chauvinists, they're proud of Western society, and they're not going to be shamed over it anymore, right? And so, you know, he kind of likened them to the Elks or some kind of drinking club type of thing. But it has grown far beyond that. And Enrique Tarrio is, of course, identifies and is Afro-Cuban. He is a person of color. He led Trump's group supporting Latinos for Trump. He's identified as leader. He's accused of conspiring with four others, co-defendants, to use force to oppose a lawful transfer of presidential power by, quote, preventing, hindering, or delaying by force the execution of the laws governing the transfer of power, according, the grand jury indictment was filed just this past week. So five men were previously indicted on charges. All five of those men were previously indicted on charges of conspiracy, and they pleaded not guilty. This recent indictment adds even more seditious elements to the count. These are very serious. It's actually very rare for these charges of sedition to be leveled. And treason, of course, when we are actually in an act of war. So many details of this new indictment have previously, they've previously been alleged in the initial conspiracy charges. Testimony came forward from a top member of the Oath Keepers, another far-right group, which is led by Stuart Rhodes, a member of the Oath Keepers testified that he overheard the leader of the group, Stuart Rhodes, trying and failing to get in touch with then President Trump at the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. His name is William Todd Wilson. He's a leader of the North Carolina chapter of the Oath Keepers. He claims that Rhodes made a call on speakerphone to an unidentified person. Wilson heard Rhodes repeatedly implore the individual to tell President Trump to call upon groups like the Oath Keepers to forcibly oppose the transfer of power. This individual denied Rhodes' request to speak directly with the president. Another thing to look at is Roger Stone's ties to these groups. Stone has been a longtime ally of Trump, and he was pardoned by the former president after he was convicted for lying to Congress in relation to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia interference in the 2016 election. And he has been long connected to the Proud Boys. In fact, in February 2018, a video emerged of Stone declaring himself to be, quote, a Western chauvinist. which is how members of the all-male group describe themselves, and has frequently used Proud Boys for personal security and pose for pictures with its members. And according to the Daily Beast, the video was part of an initiation in which Stone declared himself to align, declared to be aligned with the group. So he has denied that he is a member of the Proud Boys. And so, and he did use Proud Boys as protection when he attended the Republican conference in Salem, Oregon in 2018. So let's listen to that audio that I mentioned earlier about Liz Cheney, how she, of all people, has ended up leading the Republican fight against Trump and the January 6th insurrection.
Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the vice chair of the committee, has emerged as the public face of the investigation.
If those responsible are not held accountable, and if Congress does not act responsibly, this will remain a cancer on our constitutional republic, undermining the peaceful transfer of power at the heart of our democratic system. We will face the threat of more violence in the months to come, and another January 6th every 4 years.
Cheney is a very odd figurehead for the movement to prosecute the ex-president's attempted coup in the court of public opinion. She provides an interesting case study for the question, what does a politician do when they want to be part of a political party that doesn't want them? I've covered Cheney's political career for almost a decade now. To be honest, spent much of it viewing her as a kind of an object of scorn. I mean, she is a hard right Republican and one of the most extreme foreign policy hawks in the party. Before entering politics, the first time she sort of came on my radar screen, she was probably best known for her policy group, Keep America Safe, which levied some pretty disgusting attacks against Obama-era Department of Justice officials who had, in private practice before they joined the government, defended Guantanamo Bay detainees. Cheney formally launched her political career in 2013 by trying to carpetbag a Wyoming Senate seat, despite being born in Wisconsin and spending much of her adult life in Virginia. In fact, as The Intercept reports, Cheney, quote, launched a campaign to represent Wyoming in Congress with a Facebook post geotagged McLean, Virginia, her real home. Cheney ended up dropping out of that race before the primary. But 2 years later, in 2016, she ran for and won Wyoming's only House seat. That's the one her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, held for a decade back in the 1980s. And she quickly rose in the party ranks, becoming the third ranking Republican in the House, a position also previously held by her father. And for the duration of the Trump administration, Cheney was a bog standard right-wing Republican, if not more conservative than most of her peers. She would occasionally criticize Trump in public, but usually attacking his foreign policy, again, from the right. Cheney voted with Trump's agenda nearly 93% of the time. That's more than, for instance, Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky or staunch Trump ally Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida. And then January 6th happened. And Cheney, like most of her party and the country as a whole, was obviously sincerely and genuinely outraged. Now, at one level, she appears to clearly have made a political calculation that not only was Trump's conduct morally indefensible on substance, it was bad politics as well. You can hear her on a leaked phone call with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on January 10th asking if Trump will resign.
And you asked, what happens if it gets there after he's gone? Is there any chance, are you hearing, that he might resign? Is there any reason to think that might happen?
I've had a few discussions. My gut tells me no. I'm seriously thinking of having that conversation with him tonight. I haven't talked to him in a couple days.
You can hear in that conversation that Cheney and McCarthy are sort of on the same page, right? Didn't last, because at a certain point, other Republicans, McCarthy among them, who had some mix of the first order abject horror at what had happened and the second order political concerns, realized the way the politics were blowing and just retreated. They either shut up. changed everything, correctly noting that Trump was a unique threat to our democracy. But for the time, she remained in House leadership, even though Kevin McCarthy tried to oust her. The first time, in February of 2021, he used a secret ballot vote, and the Republican conference overwhelmingly voted for her to stay. And over the coming months, the party began to sour on Cheney as Trump tightened his grip on the Republican conference. In May of 2021, they voted again to strip Cheney of her leadership role. This time, McCarthy...
It's cut. I cut the audio.
The parallels between President Richard Nixon and President Donald Trump. And quote, so Bob, in a new piece for the Washington Post, you and Carl Bernstein write about the parallels between President Richard Nixon and President Donald Trump. And quote, you write this, President George Washington, in his celebrated 1796 farewell address, cautioned that American democracy was fragile. Cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, he warned. Two of his successors, Richard Nixon and Donald Trump, demonstrate the shocking genius of our first president's foresight. As reporters, we had studied Nixon and written about him for nearly half a century, during which we believed with great conviction that never again would America have a president who would trample the national interest and undermine democracy through the audacious pursuit of personal and political self-interest. And then along came Trump. Both Nixon and Trump have been willing prisoners of their compulsions to dominate and to gain and hold political power through virtually any means. In leaning so heavily on these dark impulses, they defined two of the most dangerous and troubling eras in American history. As Washington warned in his farewell address more than 225 years ago, unprincipled leaders would create permanent despotism, the ruins of public liberty, and riot and insurrection. Bob, what's interesting here about this almost prediction about what could happen to our democracy, I'm curious your thoughts on perhaps the difference here is a compliant Congress, or what is the difference here that perhaps makes things more dangerous?
Well, I think it is more dangerous now. Remember, Nixon won with all of his deceit and the espionage and sabotage and cover-up campaign he conducted. Trump lost, but only, if you count it right, 47,000 votes. And Trump, at least according to my reporting, is on the comeback route. Mm-hmm. He wants to run again. And so it's interesting. Trump was, as we know, president for 4 years, and he learned some things about the levers of power. If he becomes president again, I think there's going to be not as much ambiguity. I think he will clearly do some things that are frightening to power again as president. So this needs to be examined. But I'm glad you went back and read what George Washington said. Washington, 2 centuries ago, said it's fragile, democracy, and we better worry about it. And the worry continues on so many fronts. Something Bob Costa and I wrote about in Peril, about Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Milley dealing with nuclear weapons and the fear he had, and then Nancy Pelosi, of all people, whether you like or dislike Nancy Pelosi, she has an instinct for figuring out the moment. And this was 2 days after January 6th. She and Milley have a conversation in which she says, and Costa and I have a transcript of this. She says to Milley, Trump is crazy. How do you know he won't use nuclear weapons? How do you know he's not under control? And Milley tries to calm her down. But one of the most extraordinary things that I've ever reported on, Milley had to call in the watch officers, 24/7 watch officers in the Pentagon, in the National Military Command Center, who handle the communication between the president and the forces. Milley literally had to call him in and say, I want each of you to swear that you understand that our procedures will ensure that I, Chairman Milley, am involved in any discussion to use military force or nuclear weapons. I mean, the idea that we had to worry about this, that Nancy Pelosi was worried about it. Now, listen to CIA Director Burns on his public warnings, echoing what Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, has said and threatened to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. But we are visiting these problems, which are not just incidental, but they have to do with our democracy, and in some way have to do with our survival.
So there you're listening to Bob Woodward being interviewed on MSNBC discussing a recent piece that he and Woodward and Bernstein wrote for the Washington Post. And I thought I made a little law, including the whole nuclear war thing, because that's another focus of mine, is writing about, I grew up in Richland, Washington, where they refined plutonium before we lived there to build the atomic weaponry that really fueled the Cold War, and also with the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki and detonated at Trinity Site in New Mexico. So my next two books are going to be dealing with the atomic age and with uranium mining in Indian country. And so I think that this destabilization, I mean, I don't, as a Native woman whose homelands are under occupation by the United States, I don't hold the Founding Fathers or a lot of these things very highly, obviously. But the quote from Washington, the first president of the United States, in his farewell address more than 225 years ago, where he warns against unprincipled leaders who could create permanent despotism, the ruins of public liberty, and riot and insurrection, are very apt for this moment. And he of course set the standard, set the kind of term limit where he refused to run after two terms. And he also initially refused, there was offers for him to be king, right, to actually be king of the United States, and he refused that. And so as much as I disagree with Washington on so many things, as far as, you know, he used a total war against my husband's ancestors there in New York State, you know, just devastating whole towns and communities, killing babies and children and everyone. That's why they call him the town killer in the Iroquois Confederacy. And then did not uphold his part of a treaty he signed with one of my husband's direct ancestors, Chief Joseph Brandt. And as much as I do not like him, but I do agree that that is prescient warning and to what someone like Trump is about. I wanted to play some audio of Trump bullying Pence, which is in some ways hilarious, but in other ways, once again, a sign of things to come, right? Of this form of sort of mafioso sort of tactics that seems to have completely taken over or is on the verge of taking over and leading to fascism. And then, you know, the other larger destabilizing event affects whether, you know, it had to do with Trump removing us from, you know, any kind of climate change accords or from trying to remove us from NATO, which would have been pretty terrible considering what has happened with Putin. And then, of course, the threats of the use of having, if he were to win in 2024, you know, of course, he'd be very elderly at that point. But the threat of nuclear, of him using nuclear weapons, is definitely a real thing. I think it's and then the fact that the chief of staff Milley had to go and actually lecture his officers about that they're about the chain of command, and because when the way Trump works is he tries to bully people into submission and then to make sure that their loyalty lies with him, not with principles like democracy. And so you see this happening all over the country, where political candidates for the Republican Party have to make these sorts of loyalty oaths to him. So thank you so much. And this is Jackie Keeler at American Stand-Up.